that time, the Parliament, British Parliament, was small, corrupt. Many members of Parliament got their money from the slave trade. At the age of 21, Wilberforce became a Christian. His whole life changed. And he said, maybe I should become a missionary or a preacher or a pastor. And one very wise man said, no, don't. You will serve God much better in the place where your talents are best used. You are good at politics. Go into the Parliament. At the age of 27, this one man, Wilberforce, said, I believe God has given me two tasks. One, ending slavery in England. Two, changing the moral condition of England. Can you imagine one person saying, I want to change the way people behave in my country? How crazy! And yet, he died in 1833. 3 days before he died, slavery was ended by the British Parliament. And already there were so many changes in England that the condition of the country had changed. All because of Wesley, Wilberforce and others. People who said, God has called us to change the lifestyle of this nation. Now, you have to ask yourself, how did Wilberforce do this? Was he popular? No. He was hated. Who hated him? I'll tell you who hated Wilberforce. Nice, pleasant, rich people. Friendly, hospitable. Where do you think they got their money? From the slave trade. He was the most unpopular man in England, and yet he felt God had called him to this work. He had a few friends who worked with him, and gradually the moral power of the message of Christ changed the thinking of the whole people of England. And the people of England abolished the slave trade. Not only did they do that in 1833, they sent the British Navy all over the oceans of India to stop slavery. A book has been written saying that the British Navy probably saved 300,000 people from slavery, which was being conducted by the Arabs and various other people. And of course, eventually America abolished slavery, but only after a terrible civil war 30 years later. So what this shows is that one person alone, if God is calling him and if he has the conviction to move forward in the face of opposition, can change the life of a nation. That's just England. But I want to tell you about one other country where the same desire for ethical change led to wonderful changes. India. India was ruled by the British from about the middle, well, from about the 1750s onwards. The British ruled India. Now you say to yourself, what kind of British? Well, I'll tell you what kind. The same people who made money from slavery. Why did they go to India? To make money. Did they want to change India? No. Leave the Indians to do their own thing. We'll just make some money, go back to England. But what were the Indians doing? What was the society like? It was a very cruel society. Children were thrown by their mothers to the crocodiles to please the gods. Human beings were sacrificed. Women were burned when their husbands died. It was a very cruel society. There was no education for women at all. None. The Indians did not even have an alphabet, a written alphabet, for the ordinary languages. The only way you could read a book in India was to read Sanskrit. Sanskrit's this beautiful ancient language with a lovely writing system, but the local language was not written in Sanskrit. So if you were an Indian and you wanted to read about science, you wanted to read about America, you wanted to read about France, how did you do it? You had to read English books. There were no books in your own language that you could read. William Carey, I don't know where I put his name up. William Carey said, this is wrong. This is wrong. We must allow all Indians to receive education, from whatever background, male or female. And who do you think opposed this? Obviously, some of the Indian princes did, but many of the British traders opposed this. Why? Because they thought if you started educating Indians, then you couldn't make as much money. And even worse, if you educated Indians, maybe they might one day say, we don't want the British here anymore. The big debate in the English Parliament in the 1830s. Incredible story. And the people on the side of Carey and Wesley, they said this, the only moral reason we can be in India is to give independence to the Indians. It's the only moral reason we have to be there. We have no right to be in India unless that is our goal. Incredible! And so from that moment forward there were reforms. They started bringing education, civil service, many other reforms. They brought printing presses, they put the language down. All of the modern languages of India have writing systems because the Christian missionaries gave them to the Indians. They didn't exist before. Many things that Indians take for granted were brought not by the English traders, but by the Christians who said, we have a duty to these people. And in fact, there's a wonderful book by an Indian Christian who shows that without the Christian change in Indian life, independence would have been impossible because the Indians wouldn't have had the education. They wouldn't have had the writing system. So there's another case of a life of an entire nation changed by the Christian moral convictions of people who say all human beings are created in God's image. We Christians have a duty to treat every human being with the love, the concern, the nurture that God gave us. We can only give back a tiny portion of what God has given us, but that is our calling. And that indeed is the ethical challenge that Christians have today, wherever they are, whether it's here in the United States. There were many, many moral battles to be won against pornography, against the condition in American schools, against crime. And there are many ethical struggles in different parts of the world. I think it's clear that God wants Christians not only just to pray and to be good citizens and to go to church and to read the Bible, but to be salt and light in the whole world, in any society. Whether you are a university professor or a student, whether you are a politician, whether you are a journalist, I've helped organize a group of journalists, international journalists, from all over the world, and we're having a big conference in England in August. And we believe it's possible to change journalism. It's possible to change any area of life if you believe that God created it. He's given you talents and a calling to be used within that profession. One final point and then I'll stop and open it up for questions. I have always been amazed how one or two individuals can have an effect upon whole countries. And I wrote a book recently discussing the lives of six people. I call it Six Who Changed the Century. And I just want to mention two. One was African and one was Russian. Let's start with the Russian. I wrote about the writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Now, Solzhenitsyn is still alive, and he was put in prison by the Soviet communist authorities for some silly crime. It wasn't a crime. He'd written in a letter something about the man with the mustache. He meant Stalin. So they put him into prison. Stalin. He was 8 years in the prison. He nearly died. When he went into prison, he was an atheist. He was a typical Soviet citizen brought up in atheism. God doesn't exist. Science has proved there is no God. But you know, the people in the prison who most impressed him were the Christians. There was something about the quality of their love that was just very attractive. And also, when he started arguing with them about creation, they had better arguments than he did. He became a Christian in prison. And he began to sense that God's calling upon him was to tell the truth about this terrible system of prison camps that Stalin had organized. And what he did was he began to talk to other prisoners, and he said, "Tell me what happened." And they would tell him how they got arrested and how their parents were taken away and the torture. And he wrote it down on a tiny little piece of paper, which he couldn't keep, and then he memorized it. He memorized 10,000 lines of these stories in verse. He gets out of prison, he becomes a school teacher, and after teaching, he goes into this little room, makes sure nobody's looking, and then he writes it all out in a tiny little print, all of the details, gets it on the paper, very thin paper. He rolls the paper up, puts it in a bottle, and buries the bottle in the ground. He believed that what he wrote would never be published in his lifetime. But you know what he believed? It was the truth. He felt his calling was to speak the truth to his fellow country people. How it changed, he didn't know, but they needed to hear the truth. And you know the rest of the story. He wrote The Gulag Archipelago, he wrote One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, he got the Nobel Prize, and the Soviet system collapsed. Now, obviously it wasn't just Solzhenitsyn, but I'll tell you a story. I went back with Solzhenitsyn to Russia in 1994, his first visit, after the government had changed and they allowed him to come back. And I wasn't there, but I heard about this later. He was on a train, and the train stopped somewhere in the middle of Siberia. And he had this meeting. And this is the famous writer Solzhenitsyn come to talk to the Russians. And a lot of people in the audience didn't like him, because they were very strong communists, and they thought what he'd done was bad. And one man stood up, very angry, waving his fist in his crown, and says, You are responsible. He said, "What?" He said, "You brought communism down in our country." Now, if I was a writer and somebody said that to me, I'd say, "Thank you very much. I don't think I did that." But the point was, he wanted to speak the truth. His calling was to the truth. And truth has a way of changing everything. The final story is an African, Nelson Mandela. And Mandela, a black South African who hated the system of the white control of the blacks in South Africa, very unjust system. And he became a lawyer, and he's determined to fight against it. And they caught him, and they put him in jail. And they didn't torture him, but they treated him badly. They treated all of the African prisoners just badly in a general sense. And when he was in prison, he became a Christian. And he began to realize that if there was ever going to be change in South Africa, it had to be a peaceful change. And it had to be a change where the people who'd been doing the bad things realized that they had done wrong, and that the people who they had done bad things to were morally superior to them. And the amazing thing is, this man in prison, he began to convert his guards. Some of the white South African guards who didn't like black people and they thought he was a revolutionary and he was a communist. But when they saw what he was like, they saw the dignity, the truthfulness, the honorableness of this man. They realized that there was something extraordinary about him. And so in 1990, when the white government had nobody to turn to, they were beginning to collapse, they went to this man in the prison and they said, "Please, can we do an agreement with you?" Yes, that's right. In a sense, be our leader. Of course, it was a bit more complicated. They had elections and so on. But this man, when he came out of prison, he said, "The most important thing is to forgive." Forgiveness. Now, forgiveness is not one of those moral concepts in the Tao. It is a very Christian concept. It is a Christian concept that changes lives over and over again. If somebody has done something bad to you and you forgive them, it will change you and it will change them. And so, two people, one as calling to truth, Solzhenitsyn, one, according to forgiveness, have changed the lives of two nations in the last 25 years. And I believe God wants to do that all over the world, including China. How in China, I don't know. I don't know. But I do know that the Christian gospel and the way it changes ethics will convert one country after another and bring about the presence of God in the lives of nations in a way that no other system of political change or revolution will accomplish. And it always happens quietly. It happens amongst the humble. But sometimes God picks on certain people like Wilberforce and he says, "I'm calling you into political position. And God will use you." I'll stop there. If you've got any questions, I know you have time to go on.
What's the title of your book, Six Men?
A Great Soul, Six Who Changed the Century. I've got it. They're selling it at the in the main auditorium area.
Well,
Nobody was punished then.
Not punished.
That's true.
Not killed illegally.
But I think there's going to be a need for forgiveness if there is political change in China.
I think different nations can be based on forgiveness. I think based on Chinese party could be.
It needs individuals and it needs large numbers of people who are willing to live with them. Yeah, a lot of work. Yeah. Anything? Yeah.
I have a question. You're talking about people going to Christian going to college.
Right.
Big impact on the country.
Right.
But as a Christian, if you really get into the politics, such as you go to China politics.
Yeah.
And can be right now. I mean, China is not very un-Christian country.
Right.
So they, for instance, they have come up with some policies against Christianity.
Right. Right.
And the government official.
Right. Right.
Are you going to obey these or not?
Well, these are difficult questions. If you are in politics, do you obey a rule that says you must do something against Christians? I think you don't. But I think in God's time, I don't know when, there will be people, Chinese, in politics who have a position to make decisions on a Christian view that really change the life of the country. Maybe not right now, but I think there are probably already Christians somewhere hidden around in the Chinese system who are willing to make brave and courageous decisions. I think we have to stop. I'm getting orders to go, so thank you very much.
Thank you
so much.